the Time Traveler, for so it will be convenient to speak of him, was expounding a recondite matter to us. His gray eyes shone and twinkled. His unusually pale face was flushed and animated. The fire burned brightly, and the soft radiance of incandescent lights and the lilies of silver caught the bubbles that flashed and passed in our glasses. Our shares, being his patents, embraced and caressed us rather than submitted to being sat upon. And there was that luxurious after-dinner atmosphere when the thoughts roam gracefully free of the trammels of precision. And he put to us in this way, marking the points with his lean forefinger as we sat and lazily admired his earnestness over this new paradox, as we thought it, in his fecundity. You must follow me carefully. I shall have to controvert one or two ideas that are almost universally accepted. The geometry, for instance, that they taught us in school is founded on a misconception. It is not that rather a large thing to expect us to begin upon, said Philby, an argumentative person with red hair. I do not mean to ask you to accept anything without reasonable ground for it. You will soon admit as much as I need from you. You know, of course, that a mathematical line, a line of a thickness of nil, has no real existence. They taught you that. Neither has a mathematical plane. These things are mere abstractions. That is all right, said the psychologist. Nor, having any length, breadth, thickness, a cube can have any real existence. There object, said Philby. Of course a solid mass may exist, all real things. So must people think. But wait a minute. Can an instantaneous cube exist? Don't follow you, said Philby. Can a cube that does not last for any time at all have a real existence? Philby became pensive. Clearly, the time traveler proceeded, any real body must have an extension in four directions. It must have length, breadth, thickness, and duration. But through a natural infirmity of the flesh, which I explain to you in a moment, we incline to overlook this fact. There are really four dimensions, three of which we call the three planes of space, and a fourth, time. There is, however, a tendency to draw an unreal distinction between the former three dimensions and the latter, because it happens that inner consciousness moves intermittently in one direction along the latter from beginning to end of our lives. That, said a very young man, making spasmodic efforts to relight his cigar over the lamp, that, very clear indeed. Now, it is very remarkable that this is so extensively overlooked, continued the time traveler, with a slight ascension of cheerfulness. Really, this is what is meant by the fourth dimension, though some people who talk about the fourth dimension do not know what they mean. It is only another way of looking at time. There is no difference between time and any of the other three dimensions of space, except that our consciousness moves along it. But some foolish people who've got a hold of the wrong side of the idea, who've heard all they have to say about this fourth dimension. I have not, said the provincial mayor. It is simply this, that space, as our mathematicians have it, is spoken of as having three dimensions, which one might call length, breadth, and thickness. And it is always definable by reference to three planes, each at right angles to the other. But some philosophical people have been asking, why three dimensions? Particularly, why not another direction at right angles to the other three? And have even tried to create a fourth dimensional geometry. Professor Simon Newcomb was expounding to this New York Mathematical Society only a month ago. You know how a flat surface, which has only two dimensions, can't represent a figure of three-dimensional solid. Similarly, they think that by models of three dimensions, they could represent one of four, if they could master the perspective of the thing. So, see? I think so, murmured the provincial mayor, knitting his brows. He lapsed into an introspective state. His lips started moving as one who repeats mystic words. Yes, I think I see it now, he said after some time, brightening in a quite transitory manner. Well, I don't mind telling you that I have been at work upon this geometry of four dimensions for some time. Some of the results are curious. For instance, here is a portrait of a man at 8 years old, another at 15, and another at 17, another at 23, and so on. All these are evidently sections, as it were. Three-dimensional representations of its fourth-dimensional being, which is fixed and unalterable thing. Scientific people, proceeded the time traveler after the pause required for the proper assimilation of this, know very well that time is only a kind of space. Here it is a popular scientific diagram, a weather record. This line I trace with my finger shows the movement of the barometer. Yesterday it was so high. Yesterday night it fell. Then it is morning it rose again, so gently upward to here. Surely the mercury did not trace this line in any of the dimensions of space generally recognized. But certainly it traced such a line that we must conclude was along the time dimension. But, said the medical man, starting hard at coal in the fire, if time is really only a fourth dimension of space, why is it and why has it always been regarded as something different? And why can't we move in time as we move in the other dimensions of space? The time traveler smiled. Are you sure we can move freely in space? Right and left we can go, backward and forward freely enough, and men have always done so. I admit we move freely in two dimensions, but what about up and down? Gravity limits us there. Not exactly, said the medical man. There are balloons. But before balloons, save for our spasmodic jumping and the inequalities of surface, man had no freedom of vertical movement. Still, they could move up and down a little, said the medical man. Easier, far easier, down than up. And you cannot move at all in time. You cannot get away from the present moment. My dear sir, that is just where you are wrong. That is just where the whole world has gone wrong. We have always getting away from the present moment. Our mental existence, which are immaterial and have no dimension, are passing along the time dimension with a uniform velocity from cradle to grave. Just as we could travel down if we began our existence 50 miles above the Earth's surface. But the great difficulty is this, interrupted the psychologist. You can move about in all dimensions of space, but you cannot move about in time. That is the germ of my great discovery. But you are wrong to say that we cannot move about in time. For instance, if I am recalling an instant very vividly, I go back to the instance of its occurring. I have become absent-minded, as you say. I jump back for a minute. Of course, we have no means of staying back for any length of time, any more than a savage or an animal has of staying 6 feet above the ground. But a civilized man is better off than the savage in this respect. He can go up against gravity in a balloon. And why should he not, that ultimately may be able to stop or accelerate his drift along the time dimension? Or even turn about and travel in the other way? Oh, this, began Filmy, is all... Why not? Said the time traveler. It's against all reason, said Filby. What reason? Said the time traveler. You can show black is white by argument, said Filby, but you will never convince me. Possibly not, said the time traveler. But now you begin to see the objects of my investigations into the geometry of four dimensions. Long ago, I had a vague inkling of a machine. To travel through time, exclaimed the very young man, that shall travel indifferently in any direction of time and space as the driver determines. Philby contented himself with laughter. But I have experimental verification, said the time traveler. It would be remarkably convenient for the historian, said the psychologist. One might travel back and verify the accepted account of the Battle of Hastings, for instance. Don't you think that would attract attention, said the medical man? Our ancestors had no great tolerance for anachronisms. One might go get one's Greek from the very lips of Homer and Plato, the very young man thought. In which case, they would certainly plow you for the little though. The German scholars have improved Greek so much. Then there is the future, said the very young man. Just think, one might invest all one's money, leave it to accumulate at interest, and hurry on ahead. To discover a society, said I, directed on a strictly communist basis. Of all the wild extravagant theories, began the psychologist. Yes, it seemed to me, and so I never talked of it until... Experimental verification, cried I. You are going to say that. Verify that. The experiment, cried Philby, who was getting weary-brained. Let us see your experiment anyhow, said the psychologist, though it's all humbug, you know. The time traveler smiled round at us. Then, still smiling faintly, with his hands deep in his trouser pockets, he walked slowly out of the room, and we heard his shuffling down the long passageway of the laboratory. The psychologist looked at us. I wonder what he's got. Some sleight of hand trick or another, said the medical man. And Philby tried to tell us about a conjurer he had seen at Burslem, but before he finished his preface, the time traveler came back, and Philby's anecdote collapsed. The thing the time traveler held in his hands was a glittering metallic framework, scarcely larger than a small clock, and a very delicately made. There was ivory in it, and some transparent crystalline substance. And now, I must be explicit, for this is that follows, unless this explanation is to be accepted, is an absolutely unaccountable thing. He took from one of the small octagonal tables that was scattered about his room, and set it in front of the fire with two legs on the hearth rug. On the table he placed the mechanism. He drew up a chair and sat down. The only other object on the table was a small shaded lamp, the bright light of which fell upon the model. There was perhaps a dozen candles about, two in a brass candlestick above the mantel, and several in sconces. So, the room was brilliantly illuminated. I sat in a low armchair nearest the fire and drew this forward as to be almost between the time traveler and the fireplace. Philby sat behind him over his shoulder. The medical man and the provincial mayor watched him in profile from the right, the psychologist from the left. The very young man stood behind the psychologist. We were all on the alert. It appeared incredible to me that any kind of trick, however subtly conceived, and however adroitly done, could have been played upon us under such circumstances. The time traveler looked at us, and then at the mechanism. "Well," said the psychologist. "This little affair," said the time traveler, resting his elbows upon the table and pressing his hands together above the apparatus, "is only a model. It is my plan for a machine to travel through time. You will notice that it looks strangely askew, and there is an odd twinkling appearance about this bar, as though it were in some way unreal." He pointed to that part with his finger. "Also, here is a small white beaver, and here is another." The medical man got up out of his chair and peered into the thing. "It's beautifully made," he said. "It took me 2 years to make," retorted the time traveler. Then, when we had all imitated the actions of the medical man, he said, "Now, I want you clearly to understand that this lever, being pressed over, sends the machine gliding into the future, and this other one reverses the motion. The saddle represents the seat of the time traveler. Presently, I am going to press the lever, and off the machine will go. It will vanish, pass into the future time, and disappear. Have a good look at the thing. Look at the table, too, and satisfy yourselves that there is no trickery. I don't want to waste this model and then be told I'm a quack." There was a minute's pause before. The psychologist seemed about to speak to me, but changed his mind. Then the time traveler put forth his finger toward the lever. "No," he said suddenly. "Lend me your hand." Turning to the psychologist, he took the individual's hand into his own and put him to his forefinger. So that is where the psychologist himself was sent forth, the model time machine, on its interminable voyage. We all saw the lever turn. I am absolutely certain there was no trickery. There was a breath of wind. The lamp flame jumped. One of the candles on the mantel was blown out. The little machine suddenly swung around, became indistinct, was seen as a ghost for perhaps a second, as an eddy of a faintly glittering brass and ivory. It was gone, vanished. Save for the lamp, the table was bare. Everyone was silent for a moment. Then Philby said he was damned. The psychologist recovered from his stupor, suddenly looked under the table. At that, the time traveler laughed shrilly. "Well," he said, with a reminiscence of the psychology. Then getting up, he went to the tobacco jar and mantel. With his back to us, he began to fill his pipe. We stared at one another. "Look here," said the medical man. "Are you in earnest about this? Do you seriously believe that this machine has traveled into time?" "Certainly," said the time traveler, stooping to light a spill in the fire. Then he turned, lighting his pipe, to look in the psychologist's face. The psychologist, to show that he was not unhinged, helped himself to a cigar and tried to light it uncut. "What is more, I have a big machine nearly finished in there," he indicated the laboratory, "and when it is all put together, I shall have to journey on my own account." "You mean to say that that machine has traveled into the future?" said Spilby. "Into the future or the past, I don't know for certain which one." After an interval, the psychologist had an inspiration. "It must have gone into the past, if it has gone anywhere," he said. "Why?" said the time traveler. "Because I presume that it has not moved in space. If it had traveled into the future, it would still be here all this time, since it must have traveled through this time. But," I said, "if it had traveled into the past, we would have been visible when we came to this room, and last Thursday we were here, and Thursday before that, and so forth." "Serious objections," remarked the provincial mayor with an air of impartiality. turning toward the time traveler. "Not a bit," said the time traveler, and to the psychologist. "You think you can explain it is presentation below the threshold, you know, diluted presentation." "Of course," said the psychologist and reassured us. "This is a simple point of psychology. I should have thought of it. It's plain enough and helps the paradox delightfully. We cannot see it, nor can we appreciate this machine any more than we can see the spoke of a wheel spinning or a bullet flying through the air. It is traveling through time 50 times or 100 times faster than we are. And if it gets through a minute while we are getting through a second, the impression it creates will, of course, be only 1/50th or 1/100th of what it would make if it were not traveling in time." "That is plain enough." He passed his hand through space in which the machine had been. "You see," he said, laughing. We sat and stared at the bacon table for a minute or so. Then the time traveler asked us what we thought of it all. "It sounds plausible enough tonight," said the medical man, "but wait till tomorrow. Wait for the common sense of the morning. What would you like to see? The time machine itself?" asked the time traveler. And therewith, taking the lamp in his hand, he led the way to a long, draughty corridor to his laboratory. I remember the vividly the flickering of the light, his clear, broad head in the silhouette, the dance of the shadows, how we had followed him, puzzling but incredulous, how there in the laboratory we beheld a larger edition of the little mechanism we had seen vanish before our eyes. Parts were made of nickel, parts of ivory, parts certainly had been filed and sawn out of rock crystal. The thing we saw was generally complete, but with a twisted crystalline bars lay unfinished upon the bench. Beside there were some sheets of drawings. I took one up for a better look at it. Quartz, it seemed to be. "Look here," said the medical man. "Are you perfectly serious, or is this some trick like that ghost you showed us last Christmas?" "Upon that machine," said the time traveler, holding the lamp aloft, "I intend to explore time. Is that plain?" I was never more serious in my life. None of us quite knew how to take it. I caught Philby's eye over the shoulder of the medical man. He winked at me solemnly.